This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Jonathan Lerner about a memoir he's written called Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Hi, David. I'm fine. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for coming to do this. So, you know, we could sort of jump in and talk about what the book is about, but I kind of think because it's a memoir, maybe you should talk a little bit about your life before the revolutionary part. You know, you don't have to obviously repeat the entire story of the book, but, you know, kind of a setup for who you were in 1967, 1968, when the so-called 60s were kind of in full force.
Okay. I'm an upper-middle-class kid from Chevy Chase, Maryland. My father was in the State Department. Actually, we lived in Taiwan for a couple of years when I was 9, 10, 11 years old. Mostly, I grew up in this beautiful, affluent, liberal suburb of Washington, where I got involved in a minor way, quite early on in the civil rights movement, when I was still in junior high school, going to picket lines to integrate housing complexes and picketing the White House during the week between the two Selma marches in 1965. I went to college at Antioch College in the fall of 65, and Antioch had a reputation as being both extremely arty and extremely radical politically. And I really went there more because it was arty than political. I was aware of politics at that point, but I wasn't much of an activist. The activism I did at Antioch was more arty, what we called guerrilla theater in those days, which
agitprop,
or people might call it performance art now.
Yeah.
Aimed at kind of blowing people's minds and raising their consciousness and getting them to go to demonstrations. And I dropped out of Antioch College in the summer of 1967. Antioch was a co-op school, which meant that you alternated quarters on campus with quarters somewhere else in a job. And by the time I dropped out, I had three jobs, one of which was working in a locked psychiatric ward, one of which was as a time study analyst sitting on a stool with a stopwatch behind tellers in a bank, clocking how long it took them to do their transactions. And the third of which was as a program advisor to a new co-op education program at an all-black university called Wilberforce University in Ohio. And that one, all of these were kind of weird jobs to do, kind of cop-like jobs, but that one really blew my mind because I was 19 years old. The director of this program was also white. The two secretaries in the program were middle-aged women, one African-American and one Native American. And my job, they were working for me. And my job—
And you were 19?
I was 19. And also, I was interviewing the students who were my peers and helping direct them to co-op jobs. And I did this job for 3 months, but it seemed completely weird that I would do this. So I left Antioch— kind of resentful at the school, thinking, you know, the school is trying to train me to be a cop, which is not really what Antioch was trying to do, but it was a sort of way of looking at it that I think reveals the direction my thinking was going at that time. In 1967, the war was escalating like crazy. In 1967, there were wild rebellious riots in black communities all over the country. And the sense that we were approaching some kind of apocalyptic revolutionary time was really building.
Yeah, that's a great lead into the book, by the way, because what the book is about is your involvement in the political movement of that time in America, which was SDS to begin with, Students for a Democratic Society, mm-hmm. Founded by some, you know, students in, I think it was Ann Arbor was where the first meeting
was.
That
was the real core of it.
Yeah, Tom Hayden and mm-hmm. Carl Oglesby, as I recall.
Yeah, and that, I'm not sure Carl was at the actual seminal meeting, but that was about 5 or 6 years earlier, in maybe 1962. Right. And SDS was originated as a sort of liberal alternative to the sort of communist-inspired student groups. It was a sort of remnant of the Cold War consciousness.
Yeah, maybe a kind of new left.
Well, it was the beginning of the new left in a way. And by the time I got into it, when I was dropping out of Antioch, it had become much more militant and very focused on the war in Vietnam.
Right. Which I think was a clearly one of the driving forces for the so-called movement. You know, as you indicate, you know, it's kind of interesting, the civil rights involvement of so many people at a very early age that led people to later become more involved in other things.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a theme I've observed with a lot of people.
I think civil rights showed us that it was possible to organize and showed us the power of organizing.
And also there was, I think, a feeling of doing a good thing.
The morality of it was unquestionable.
And working together because you're overcoming a certain gulf in the society. You know, at that time, if you were like yourself, a white privileged kid, I think I felt like I probably grew up a white privileged kid too. We didn't have any black friends.
Right.
We didn't know anybody who was black. I mean, that's not universal because there are a lot of really interesting people who grew up in New York or Boston or L.A. who probably did have, if you were white, have, you know, black or Hispanic friends. But so many suburban kids, we had no concept. So that being involved in the civil rights movement made it feel like you were engaging in overcoming a deeply felt American problem.
It felt that way. But by 1967, what was happening in the civil rights movement was the emergence of black nationalism and a really strong strain of militants. And one of the things that phenomenon was saying to us, white activists, was, you do your own thing. We're tired of you being in our organizations. We're tired of being patronized. And we were, in a sense, maybe rejected is too strong a word for it. We were sort of told, like, you do your thing, we'll do our thing. And that was a sort of existential crisis for those of us whose origins as activists had been in the civil rights movement. Even mine, as sort of glancing as my activism was at an early age, it still felt very confusing, and actually it was a hard confrontation with the fact of being white in a black context and the fact of the assumption, I think, that a lot of us probably had unconsciously that what we suggested was always the best idea. And I think that also helped create the sense of urgency. That was another factor in the sense of urgency as things were escalating toward the end of the 60s, that we needed to match in fervor the sense that was coming out of the emerging black nationalist movement, and also we needed to really prove ourselves.
And one of the things you talked about that I thought really resonated was, and we can explore this because it works in various ways, but the idea of kind of, I don't want to use the word crazy, but there's like a really almost fraught sensibility, you know, among not everyone, but I think this was fairly strongly felt in at various levels by a lot of young people at that time, however you want to define young, because it ranged over many age groups. But there was what you're talking about right now is this feeling of things being really important, you know, that there was a lot of meaning bound up in what people were doing. And that also enabled a certain level of craziness to happen, you know, in terms of making decisions that you, as you have done in this book, looked back on and thought, oh, my God, what were we thinking?
There was a lot of magical thinking. There was a lot of apocalyptic thinking and also magical thinking. the apocalyptic was thinking this war and this war against people of color, these things are so immoral, and we seem to be so ignored as we try to fight them that it has to collapse either on its own or because we tear it down, the power structure, right, the existing social relations of the country. The magical thinking, helped by the fact that a lot of us were ingesting a lot of drugs at the time, was that we could just actually do that just by getting together and more or less saying we were going to do it. it egged on by lyrics of the Rolling Stones telling us that the time was right for violent revolution and other sort of pop culture expressions of militants. And
well, and it was everywhere. There was the sense of unity as youth culture,
yeah,
was very palpable. I mean, I actually feel like that was the dominant idea among at least a certain segment, you know, particularly I think the white kids felt this idea that you were alienated from your regular life and you were entering into this new world, whether you were political or you know, cultural, the hippies, you know, as hippies and radicals, which crossed over a lot of times. But that whole sense, what you just said is very right. I think that, well, we could just do anything. You know, in fact, the Whole Earth Catalog, in some ways, which I think is a brilliant document, also encourage that notion that you can do it.
Just think it up and do it.
Be a farmer.
Yeah.
Build a geodesic dome.
Build a composting toilet and save the world.
Yeah. Literally change the world.
Yeah. We did actually change the world in a lot of ways.
Yes.
In terms of sexual politics, in terms of all kinds of cultural critique and cultural changes. It was definitely a time when we thought anything could happen. And I think another important part of this, especially for those of us like me who came from middle and upper middle class backgrounds, which was quite a lot of the people who were activists in organizations like SDS, it was a time of enormous affluence in this country. It was the peak of the post-war economic boom, so that I could drop out of a good college without any life plan, without any job. And I lived an extremely privileged existence in growing up, but my family was not actually especially wealthy. My father was a civil servant. He wasn't really supporting me, but it kind of didn't matter. I dropped out of school. I hitchhiked to New York. I got a job working in a toy store. I got fired when my friends came in and hung out with me too much. I got some other little job. It was a time of sort of dumpster diving and shoplifting from grocery stores. And maybe not probably, in the back of my mind, there was always this fact that I knew I had an affluent family or a stable family that would support me if I got in real trouble. And I think that was true for a lot of us.
I think that's true. That allows
you to be kind of dreamy and not take seriously things like making money to pay rent and buy clothes and food and pay doctor's bills. I was still on my parents' health insurance, actually, until I was 21 years old.
Right.
I used it. I mean, when I was in Chicago and the weatherman and I got an ear infection, I still had my health insurance card from Group Health in Washington. And I went into an emergency room and had my ear irrigated, and it cost me not a penny.
Right. These ironies abound, you know. But just to go back to the weather. Weatherman or weather underground, you know, I know it's various terminology.
Right. As long as weather is
part of it. Yeah. But you know, it feels like in the book, your story of becoming involved in the most radical wing of what was SDS and what splintered off and became the Weather Underground was kind of accidental and, you know, reflecting a sort of, you know, lack of clarity in a way on your part, you know, that you were just sort of, it kind of evolved without plan. You were not like a focused in a way.
I wasn't ideological. I wasn't even intellectually political. I loved the action. And I also had friends who were in it, and I followed them into it out of personal loyalty. I actually think that many people made decisions for these kind of personal and psychological reasons that we weren't really aware of making, consequential decisions. But in my case, I had no life plan. I thought I was going to be in theater, and I was taking acting and dance classes and sort of eking out a sort of marginal existence and doing like little workshop productions that nobody ever saw. And I had a close friend who was in SDS, and through him I met other people who were in SDS, and they said, oh, why don't you join the staff and you can go to the campus chapters and organize guerrilla theater groups. And I said, oh, great, I'll do that. This was a life, and it seemed to promise a lifetime, because we were going to make a revolution, and so that would take care of me for the rest of my life.
So, and that's sort of a theme that I kind of identify, not just in the book, but in thinking about that time of romanticism. You know, that and in a way, the romanticism enabled by the ease with which you could kind of flow into things, and partially that was the way the counterculture worked. That,
yeah.
You know, it was sort of just show up. Whoever showed up was in the group. You know, maybe that was a commune. You know. Like in New Mexico,
uh-huh.
You know, or Ken Kesey's group, you know, it was just people were in places and happened to be there. I mean, you know, but at the same time, the romanticism of the movement, of the political movement, I think is an important factor, you know, or important component that made people do things that they weren't really thinking clearly about,
mm-hmm.
but it seemed, as you just said, you know, like it would give you a life.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's striking, you know, that I don't think that exists today as much. You know, people are more, I don't know what it is, you know, there, maybe it's just student loans, but.
Well, I mean, that's student loans is a metaphor for what it is. I mean, student loans is a real thing, but also we're not in a time of affluence anymore for most people. And young people have no choice but to be more serious about making plans. And if you go to school to learn a profession, then doing what it takes to actually enter the profession rather than like then take off for San Francisco on your thumb. I think people don't have the choice anymore, or the sort of lax possibilities.
Well, and, I mean, this is where I interject my own political analysis. I kind of think that that is an effect of what happened in the 60s and 70s, and that is that that period really did threaten the established order. And I don't think of it as a conspiracy, you know, like three or four people sitting there and saying, we can't let this happen anymore. But there was a kind of societal counteract or a counterforce to the counterculture, you know, mm-hmm. the society, you know, it's a kind of dialectic if you want to look at it
right.
that way. You know, it's kind of things have happened that have straightened out the people that were otherwise not straight. And I think that there's a certain amount of purposefulness in the system. Not necessarily of some individual, like I said, an individual saying we've got to, you know, keep. But things like getting rid of the draft really made a huge difference, because the draft is so much what drove so many people to think hard about whether, you know, they wanted to have a war in Vietnam.
Well, and now with our so-called all-volunteer army, which is really made up of young people who don't have any other choice.
Right.
Who come from places where there's nothing to do. The rest of us, or the rest of young people, don't have to be afraid that they're going to be sent to fight a futile, tragic,
right, which
pointless
means,
war.
And it means
like
there isn't ever going to be a mass movement against a war in the same way that there was at that time.
No, it doesn't touch people in the same way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, there's another, I'm going to say personally, since my book is a memoir and it's quite personal, the other sort of unconscious or psychological thing that I think drove me to make the decisions I made that took me into such a sort of militant, cocky, macho political environment were that it gave me a way to hide being gay. And actually, I think this would be a good time for me to read a section about
yeah,
that.
I think that would be really good.
And this doesn't even really need any introduction. But I'll put on my reading glasses first, because I'm 69 years old now. I missed a lot of iconic movies in those years. Pocket money was short, and a lot of the time we had something more urgent to do, like sitting around in endless, stupefying meetings. Also, while it wasn't a formal policy, aside from rock and roll, appreciating culture, whether mass or highbrow, carried a whiff of bourgeois self-indulgence. I never visited a museum or a gallery then either, or attended a play. Of course, there were exceptions. In the summer of 1969, as Weatherman was being hammered into existence, many people went to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which was the source of our glamorization of going down in a blaze of glory. I also remember going to the movies that summer once to see Midnight Cowboy, and I found its depiction of gay hustling unsettling and seductive. I never saw Bertolucci's 1970 masterpiece, The Conformist, either, until last night, nor had I read the Alberto Moravia novel it's based on. If I had seen it back then, it would have disturbed me too, being, as described recently by the English newspaper The Guardian, as, quote, an account of the neuroses and self-loathing of a sexually confused would-be fascist, unquote, who joins Mussolini's secret police. Fascism, communism, as ethical systems or utopian visions, they differ considerably. But in actual history, the political structures that have arisen to support them are equivalent, in the sense that both can provide the opportunity to submerge homosexual panic in the appearance of normalcy and, even better, in secret work, and better still, secret work with the promise of violence. The conformist depiction of homosexual panic as motivation, in particular, resonates with me. But don't get the idea I'm beating up on gay people. Any number of confusions, insecurities, and pathologies can move people to deny their individuality and abdicate their responsibilities and critical faculties in order to join a hierarchy or cult, political or otherwise. No doubt my leftist loyalty would have prevented me from making this observation when the film was released in 1970, so it's just as well I didn't see it then.
Yeah, there's a lot in that passage, I think. You know, as you describe it, there was a really, and I kind of, you know, I wonder about that. You know, the patriarchal nature of the left movement, its anti-women kind of misogyny, its anti-gay homophobia for the most part, really kind of oddly reflected the period that people were kind of trying to revolt against. So it was almost like they couldn't see that. They could only see this one thing to revolt against.
Yes, and when the women's movement arose around 67 and 68, a lot of women who had been participating in the New Left fled the New Left and joined the women's movement and realized they could be activists and radicals and leftists and feminists all at once. And in the same way, after Stonewall in 69, when gay political organizations like the Gay Liberation Front emerged, gay people who had been in the New Left abandoned it to do political work that came from their own hearts, actually, as well as speaking to a political analysis. And that's exactly the time in June of 1969 when Stonewall happened, when I was helping form the Weather Underground, or the Weathermen, which became the Weather Underground. Right. So I knew that Stonewall happened, and I could have personally gone in that direction, and I didn't.
Well, you weren't ready. I mean, you have to...
I wasn't ready.
You just weren't. And
well, coming out is a really hard thing. I didn't come out till I was 42 years old.
Yeah.
And which makes me very aware of how hard it is, even today, even when there's so much more support for kids, there are gay teachers, there's, you know, anti-bullying campaigns in schools.
But it's complicated.
It's a hard personal thing to do.
And there's family issues for a lot of people. It doesn't matter what the society says. Yeah. You know, family often makes it hard for people. Sort of to leap ahead in the story, 1976 kind of marks the end. And, you talked, I thought it was really interesting how you described what was going on in the, you know, kind of the underground from your perspective, because you were not really in the deeply underground militant group. You were on the sort of support side.
Yeah, I was a member of the organization, but I was a member, like many other people, who was not underground.
Right.
I was in a sort of front organization and in a support relationship.
Right.
I was a secret member of. I was a public person who was secretly a member of an underground organization.
Right. And there's all kinds of interesting stuff in this book about political, you know, schisms and battles and all the things that were going on at that time, which we'll probably leave for people to read about.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really interested in, you know, that kind of period, when, you know, 1976 is when you left.
When I left. It was sort of at the beginning of the end of the underground. It took another year or so, to my knowledge, or as I'm told, rather, for the organization to completely factionalize and split apart.
And it kind of had lost its power, if you will, whether that's, you know, real power or emotional or kind of symbolic power. It really had failed earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
But it is amazing. Well, and of course, quite a few of the people that were underground stayed underground. The guys who had done things that the government was really looking to put them in jail for, some of them stayed underground for the rest of their lives.
Maybe. Most of them pretty soon, within a couple of years, came above ground, dealt with their legal problems. By then, many prosecutors were willing to let cases go because they didn't want to, like, dredge the stuff back up. There had been two federal indictments which were dropped because of FBI malpractice, you know, warrantless wiretaps and things like that.
Right. The COINTELPRO stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a few people did time, and then there are a few people who stayed underground and continued to try to do militant things. And a couple of them spent much more time in jail once they got busted, and a few of them, one or two of them, are still in jail and will be probably for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Well, it was choices that people made that had real effects.
Yeah. Yeah.
In some ways, very sad. But so you also do kind of go back and forth to the present. And I wondered what, you know, in the book, it's, I think you wrote it just before the election.
Well, I wrote it all of through the summer and fall of 2016.
Right.
So the election was happening. Black Lives Matter was happening. The Keystone Pipeline encampment was happening, and these things were on my mind as I was writing it, so I kind of mentioned them.
Well, and there's some resonance between you went to Wounded Knee in 1973 as a journalist, you know, to write about it, and then spent some time at Akwesasne.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Wounded Knee and kind of resonates with Standing Rock.
Yes.
And the pipeline.
Well, and Black Lives Matter resonates with the black movement of 50 years ago, too. And honestly, the reason I wrote the book was because a publisher asked me to write it, and he asked me to write it because he saw what kind of activism was brewing, and this is before the election, and felt that there was a real connection between the story of what had happened 50 years ago, told from a personal kind of reflective point of view.
Yeah, well, in fact, that was... You've just presaged my kind of last question, which is, you know, when you think about it, like were you thinking specifically about what you could learn from that period applied to present day issues, movements, you know, what is developing or will develop or may develop, you know, as social and political movements today?
I'm not sure I was really thinking about that when I was writing. I was really just trying to tell the story, my story. But now that the book is written and published, I realize that there are lessons to draw and parallels to draw, and there are things I have to say which are not so much tactical suggestions or strategies. I'm still not a big political thinker. But are more personal and psychological, like think about the consequences of actions before you take them and think about your own motivations for joining into an effort or an organization before you do it. because many times there's something going on within you in addition to what you think politically, intellectually, they don't cancel each other out, and they can both coexist, but it's better to be aware of them.
Well, it's almost like you're suggesting, from your experience, to be, you know, to seek to be more integrated in your being, you know, to be yourself,
yeah.
to allow yourself to be who you are, whether that's being a gay person or something else.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
that, because in a way, the involvement with the political movement enabled you to not deal with your own psyche
yeah.
with yourself.
Until much later.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and one other thing that's a lesson that I think is hard for a lot of people to understand now is that the things that are that need to be addressed now are really big and are going to be around for a long time, and it's important for people to have a very long view and not burn themselves out, and not kind of act crazy and unstrategically.
Well, there is a tendency, and we all have this, I think, in our society. It's now as well as 50 years ago, and that's to think that if we are right and our belief is correct and we do the right things, we'll get the right outcome. And that doesn't always happen right away. You know, sometimes it is a process. It takes a long time.
Yeah.
And it requires a lot of back and forth.
And incremental steps.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm funny to bring this up, but it reminds me of the Battle of Algiers, that movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, for so that it isn't a, you know, it's not like Rome wasn't built in a day. It's not, you're not going to change the world overnight. And I think that's a good lesson, because clearly in the period that you're writing about, there was, we go back to what we were originally talking about, that we thought we could change the world.
Yeah.
Right away, easily. No problem.
We were powerful. We were enormous.
Right.
We were everywhere.
Right. And we did. And as you said, lots of things did change, but not in the ways necessarily that people thought.
Well, we didn't make a political revolution.
No.
We made cultural revolutions, I would say.
Yeah. Which have their own issues. And,
sure.
You know, we can. That's a subject.
Those are long struggles, too.
Right.
I mean, it's all endless.
Right. Well, but it's good to place it in history when it's not endless. It's actually in a period of time that
uh-huh.
you lived. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about it.
Oh, thanks, Jonathan. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Jonathan Lerner about Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary. Thank you.
Thank you.